if you removed all the literature that came out of war times, that came out of trauma, that came out of difficult seasons of cultural history, you'd have to be very little. You know, you think about Hemingway, you think about Dante, you think about Fra Angelico, you think about, you know, all these masters who came out writing about their dark times. You know, these people are writing and painting and making sense of the world through beauty in times when they, you know, most people didn't even think that was possible.
You're listening to Restoring the Soul with Michael John Cusick. Welcome to the program. You're listening to Restoring the Soul. I'm Michael John Cusick. On today's program, the conclusion to my two-part conversation with Mako Fujimura, where we discuss how artists are gardeners called to till the soil of culture, how creating beauty in the midst of chaos and darkness doesn't require a budget, anyone can do it, and how a person made fully alive is the ultimate burning bush that God imparts to the world. Mako Fujimura is a visual artist whose works have been exhibited around the world, and he's the author of several books, including Culture Care, Refractions, A Journey of Faith, Art, and Culture, and his most recent book, Silence and Beauty, which combines reflections on Shusaku Endo's classic novel, Silence, with Mako's personal and theological reflections. Let's listen now to my conversation with Mako Fujimura on Restoring the Soul. You've also said that art can play a central role in making peace in the world. But how can the arts play a role in making peace?
Yeah, and this seems so absurd to say that art is essential, especially in times like this. You know, when there's chaos and unrest, there's terror and fear and anxiety, and we say, well, we need, you know, stronger military, or we need, you know, this and that. But we actually need to step back and realize that our culture has not cultivated this art of beholding, this art to pay attention to the fragile things around us, the mysteries that of beauty that fills the universe, despite the fact that we don't need them. There's no utilitarian purpose for beauty. We should, if we believe the pundits or the scholars, you know, discard those things that are necessary in order to survive. But that thought is the beginning of this dark journey toward not knowing what it is to be human, to be fully human and alive. And so, I think it was Leonard Bernstein, the conductor who said in times of darkness, we need to actually amplify the experience of beauty and to, you know, go after it. I am paraphrasing here, but deeply, there's something deeply human about seeking beauty, that when and in peaceful times or times we are very complacent, perhaps we don't think about those things, you know. But when things are being so forced into this trauma, and there's just so much pain and suffering in the world, we should provide for those who are in need, and that should be the least of what we do. But we also have to realize that compassion and beauty are two elements that can endure these moments of darkness, and they may yet generate something new into the world. And you look at the history of art and literature, if you removed all the literature that came out of war times, that came out of trauma, that came out of difficult seasons of cultural history, you'd have to be very little. You know, you think about Hemingway, you think about Dante, you think about Fra Angelico, you think about you know, all the masters who came out writing about their dark times. You know, these people are writing and painting and making sense of the world through beauty in times when they, you know, most people didn't even think that was possible. So these are the people that I've learned from, and Endo is certainly one of those people.
So the pragmatist in me wants to ask you, if you had an infinite budget and resources, what would it look like to wage peace and to allow the arts to create peace in the midst of these really turbulent times?
Yeah. So the beauty of this is that you don't need a budget to do it. It's just every day your awareness and your appreciation and your commitment to create midst of chaos and darkness. That's all you need.
So you're referring to not just a person who paints like you, or a person who creates film or literature and therefore not artistic in the traditional sense, but this idea that you get to, in culture care, the idea of generativity, that we're all called to be creators. And it's that generativity that that pushes back against the darkness. More about that generativity.
That's right. So, you know, if I had a huge budget to work with, you know, what I would do is to go back to the basics of education that allows young children in impoverished places to be able to have the basic needs met, but that would lead to experience of beauty for them, you know. And this is, you know, kind of may seem crazy, but without voice in this world that has been left untouched, and we do nothing for them, the least of these. And I think that's what we need, transformation. And the rest of us who are doing reasonably well, you know, we need that experience of hearing the voices that cannot be heard because of the constant noise that is out there in our lives, that we need to get back to the basics. But going back to culture care and generativity, yes, this is a call for everyone. If we care about the environment, and if we are hiking and we see a Coke can, we, you know, if 1,000 people did that, the trails would be clean, you know. And that same thing with culture is that if we care about culture, then rather than fighting over, you know, this limited zero-sum game of limited resource environment, why don't we see the culture as a place of abundance and care for it with very simple acts of kindness, but also tilling the soil into the future, so that the work that you do today, you may not see the result of, but your children and your grandchildren may benefit from. You know, those principles still apply. They're very simple principles. You know, leave the place better than you came into it. And you know, if we can just begin to do that and see culture not as us versus them. You know, culture wars assume that we have this culture and have this culture and they have this culture and we're fighting over it. But, you know, when you really think about it, culture is us. We need to own that. Every element that we're fighting against is an element that is, you know, whether by via negativa, of fighting against it, you know, you're still within it, right? So it's not as if you can eradicate that, which we don't desire. It's a good instinct to want, you know, wholesome, safe for the whole family, kind of a. But in you know, culture does not work like this. We are embedded. It's far more mysterious and complex than we want to think. So it's better to see culture as a garden to take care of. You know, if there are weeds, put it out. You know, if there, but that means you have to really oil the complexity of the soil and how, you know, there is no black and white judgment that you can make that is clear cut. You have to deal with the mystery of that environment and you know, test things by the fruit of your labor and learn each time that doesn't work. Have this humble approach that a you know, a farmer or a gardener will have toward their land, you know, not to rape the land for what, you know, utilitarian purposes, but to allow it to flourish so that all neighbors can flourish, not just us. Or, you know, and that attitude, you know. So I think artists are gardeners who are called to till the soil of culture. You know, it's hard work. There are many winters without happening, and yet when you know that, you know, in the spring flowers are coming up, you know that somebody invested in that soil, and that work is worthwhile because that beauty can benefit everybody.
So culture care is really, it's a very broad concept, but it's an alternative to boycotting culture, resisting culture, which often takes on an arrogant form.
Right, and there's nothing wrong with prophetically standing against the cultural forces of darkness. And I, you know, this is not a war against culture wars. You know, it really is to affirm the prophetic instinct as well. And I've been thinking a lot about this. You know, what Dr. King did in his speech, his last speech, the day that he gave day before his shot, the mountaintop speech, is just so profound because it affirms this idea that, you know, talk about war and peace all day, you know, but we're at a point in our culture where it's either nonviolence or non-existence. And if that's the case, you know, we kind of stepped over the boundary of human existence to now we have to deal with this human instinct toward imperialistic, you know, triumphalism to capture the land and win at all cost. If we are at a point where that is self-destructive ultimately, then we have to create another way of even resisting against the forces of darkness. And that's part of culture care, is that, you know, do we care enough to think about the enemy, you know, and to think about what is causing this demise and its sickness that we inherit as a culture, and how are we to create a new conversation that affirms diversity, that does not assume that you know, everybody can agree on these issues, but to be able to have this flexible way of not just coexisting, but, you know, I call this cultural estuary in the book Culture Care. Estuaries are not homogeneous. It's fantastically dangerous place, heterogeneous, with many competing elements. But that's why it's so abundant and delicate, and it feeds the creatures that are going upstream, and then it nourishes them as they go back to the ocean. It is the most fantastic most important part of the ecosystem. And so we need more cultural estuaries where we can affirm the differences as well as what we are for.
Marco, you recently accepted a position at the Brehm Center at Fuller Theological Seminary. And is the emphasis with there so that you can expand the role of culture care in your calling?
Yes, and I'm so delighted that President Mark Labaton invited me with this crazy idea to be an artist in the midst of a seminary, a major seminary, the largest seminary in the world, and to have a studio space there to work with fellows that I get to pick out and other artists in residence and good people that have for years labored to care for culture there. And scholars and theologians and, you know, psychologists. And so we're for our next summit in February 8th through 12th in Pasadena, where we bring together elements of soul care with culture care. I would love to have you there with us and to start to integrate theological formation with spiritual development and formation with cultural formation. What would look like if one community, one person held these integrated points and bring that into the world? And I'm very excited about the possibilities I'm already seeing in a short time. I'm there winter quarters, and I spend the rest of the time in Princeton studio, but I'm seeing fantastic results from even the short time that we've been doing this. And this is, I hope, will be a resource to go out there, theologians and pastors, but also people in the pews, people in entrepreneurial business practices, people who are serving, people who are working around the world, and that they will feel empowered to seek beauty when, you know, and also to understand that theological integration of the gospel, person fully made alive, is beautiful. That's the ultimate enigmatic burning bush that God imparts into the world. And every single person has the capacity to be that burning bush.
Wow, I love that.
Yeah, and you know, you're walking burning bushes, you know, and communities burning with this paradoxical reality of upholding something that is so orthodox and traditional, and yet even new. And you know, that kind of communal and I think that may be the ultimate artwork that we can be involved in.
It sounds like that vision will profoundly expand the conversation about the story of God and the beauty of that.
I think so. So the backdrop to culture care is that I had written, aside from what you read in culture care, these chapters that I gave lectures to all sorts of audiences, not just within the church, but outside the church as well. There are spiritual and theological premises that go into each of those that I don't reveal. And so I'm working on another book called Theology of Making, which may take me 3 years to finish, but it is about what we talked about, the whole narrative of the Bible, the good news that from creation to new creation, that allows for us to understand the story of God, as you say, this vast reality of mystery that we're just tapping into, I think. And artists and makers have a particular intuitive knowledge that needs to be part of the theological discourse. And so what I'm trying to do is not just to bring artists into the conversation, but have them lead in this discussion, because they hold this integrative knowledge that, to me, essence of both creation and new creation.
I think it was Bono, and interestingly, I remember this from Rolling Stone. He said that maybe in the mid-90s, I read that the artists are the prophets of the future.
Yes.
The future. I was like, that's what you're talking about. That when beauty in the story of God is presented in that kind of way, it just sounds so compelling. And I can't imagine a person who's not a follower of Jesus, but whose heart is alive, I can't imagine them not being compelled by that vision.
Right. And that's what I keep insisting on, is this is not just for artists and, you know, people who have the means to buy art. This is for everyone, and especially those who are marginalized and oppressed and today persecuted. They need to know that their voices do matter, that there is artistry, that if we can all collectively work toward an expression that allows for these voices to resonate in the most important decisions being made today in the world, then yes, it profoundly changes how we view the world, how we view politics, how we view the academic discourse. And I think that's what potentially what culture care conversation, and this is a charge that I believe we are given at the Brehm Center.
We've been speaking broadly about culture and the world, but I want to bring it back for a moment as we wrap up to the personal. In Silence and Beauty, you have a chapter called Ground Zero, and you share your story of 9/11, living two blocks from the towers where the planes hit. You also make reference to Hiroshima, the original Ground Zero, where you've spoken. Tell me about why you integrate writing about your own trauma in your work, and also how Ground Zeros are, as you say, a universal condition.
Yeah. So, actually, I was just communicating with a fellow artist friend in Paris, and his Japanese artist who, you know, waking up each morning with anxiety and trauma over what's happening in France. And I remember writing this sentence, and I'm still owning up to it. And it comes from another book that I read that a pastor recommended me to read. And it's about this dream that this one pastor had after losing everything, his wife, his mother, I think his daughters, in a single automobile accident. And he had this dream, recurring dream, of his chasing after the sunset over and over. And then I think it was his sister who said, "But you're going the wrong way. If you want to meet the sunrise, you go the other way. You go into the darkness." It's a really profound message, and one that I fail to do often. I keep running away. And so writing for me and painting for me is to go into the darkness, you know, to know that I don't know what I'm doing, and I'm not capable of surviving this, but I just have to. If I'm going to make a step, let's do that. And over the years since 9/11, actually it started for me, post depression that I went through after I heard about Columbine High School here in Colorado, and I just had this deep angst about it. I just realized that there was something so much deeper, and this darkness encroaching, you know, us, and. So I began to paint images about that, and then 9/11 happened, and I'm you know, I was forced to be Ground Zero resident, and then my kids growing up there became Ground Zero children, you know, and then realizing that my grandfather, as a scientist working for the government, had to observe Hiroshima a week or two after the bombing, and he could never talk about it, that link of generations going back to Endo's, generation, post-atomic devastation and trauma that Japan is, I think, still recovering from. Those things that I wanted to run away from kept on coming up, obviously, as I wrote this book. And so, as I said, it's not something I want to do, but I'm, you know, after going through the process, I'm glad for it, because it's something that I discovered, things that I would never have discovered otherwise. And that experience, I'm realizing, is so much more important today. So, you know, this is what I would say to people who are going through trauma right now, is that story of, you know, let's as artists turn back and try to find that sunrise on the other side. And I want to journey with them so that they can do the same. We don't know what the result of that is, but I think that journey will be profoundly important for the world, future generations. And if you have children, if you have grandchildren, you know that, you know, we can only do so little for them. But at the same time, you know, the power of creativity and this reality of love, right, that flows us into this creative reality, is what God will use to hold the world together, and so this is a journey that I've been on, and you know, part of what I try to do when I lecture or when I teach or when I mentor people is to try to do that, to be alongside.
I just want to say thank you for your faithfulness to your calling that has so many diverse aspects to it. And my hope is that many more people find out about your books and your writing through this interview. So, Mako Fujimura, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to another episode of Restoring the Soul. Learn more about how we cultivate freedom and wholeness of heart at restoringthesoul.com.